You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where there was so much farce this week it overloaded our circuits and took out our third segment. I'm your host, Justin M. Wozdeski, and if you get a chance, could you please tell a friend? Please? You know, just if you get a chance. I don't wanna inconvenience you or anything. I'm being very deferential today. Maybe I should hand the show over to the people joining me this trip. From our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Did you have a stroke? Why are you being deferential? That seems out of character. It's a good pod. It's a good pod right there. You just shake your head and go, meh.
I don't know. I just thought it would be a funny bit to start the show. I don't know. It's just like there's so much news this week. I can't really think of anything to talk about besides that. And also, maybe it was because I was deferential to the listeners and I watched Chuck a lot. And let's not spoil that. So I think if you've been listening to this show long enough, I think you can figure out what I'm implying.
Spoiler alerts on a movie that came out from the year 2000.
Oh, I'm not talking about spoiler alerts. I mean spoiler alerts for this episode.
Oh, I see. That's right. We got to string them along. Now that's good pod. You're foreshadowing.
Also joining us from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, which means we should probably all defer to him, Daniel. William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, it's still unusually chilly here in California.
What?
I know. It's been great. I hope this stays this temperature all summer long. Below 60 degrees in the morning. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I know. It's 59 degrees in the morning. And then it gets to 75 during the day. It's below 60.
Yeah. Ooh, if this temperature was in San Diego, there would be mass panic. But thank God for climate change.
That's right. Thank God for the Green New Deal.
That covers a lot of the episode right there. I mean, you want to just call it right now?
I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you. No, I don't want to call it right there because we have things to dive into and people to excoriate.
As you can tell, I think Daniel is really excited about the news this week. As I was typing up all the news, I was like, man, this is like a Daniel-centric news episode.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into it in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. Isn't just a fad.
Thanks for everyone to for turning in. Oh my God, did I have a stroke in between the song and the news?
That was worse than my opening. Jesus,
what the hell was that? Thanks everyone for tuning in this week. We especially appreciate our Patreon supporters. You can be a Patreon supporter too at patreon.com/themidside. But enough about that. What we're really here to talk about this week is climate change and the bill you're going to pay at your restaurant in California. Yes, the two are finally coming together. It was an inevitability, wasn't it, Justin? Thanks to a Midsider Frank for alerting us to this story from the San Francisco Chronicle, titled, What's Behind a New Climate Surcharge Coming to Your Restaurant Bill in California? Some California restaurants will put another surcharge on their bills later this year, but this time it won't be for service or employee benefits. It will be to fight climate change. The initiative announced Wednesday is called Restore California Renewable Restaurants, and it will allow restaurants statewide the option of charging diners an additional 1%. This sentence says they money would go toward California's Healthy Soil Program, which helps farmers transition to methods that put carbon back in the soil. It's a partnership between the California Department of Food and Agriculture, the California Air Resources Board, and the Perennial Farming Initiative, a San Francisco nonprofit. Quote, Farmers and ranchers have long been on the forefront of the battle against climate change, Food and Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross said in a statement. This partnership is an opportunity for eaters and buyers to share in land-based solutions. Karen Leibowitz and Anthony Myant, a married couple who are founders of the Perennial Farming Initiative, first got the state's attention last fall during the Global Climate Action Summit when their other nonprofit, Zero Foodprint, led by more than 40 Bay Area restaurants and going carbon neutral for a week. They're also restaurateurs known for Mission Chinese Food, Commonwealth, and their now closed environmentally minded spot called The Perennial. Key words there, now closed. Justin, I know that what you were thinking about the story was that everything in California is just not quite expensive enough. What we really needed was one more expense, especially on food and drink. Am I right?
Oh, you read my mind. Exactly. I mean, I don't know if this has already been done before. You guys can check me on that with what I'm about to say, because to me, this is new. This is sort of the new California strategy for taxing more, is they're smuggling in these very small surcharges onto things they're not related to and getting people to pay them because they think people aren't going to notice them. I'm sure that's been done on some level, but they're doing it more and more now. Of course, the first big one was Senate Bill 1 with the gas tax and the car title tax, where now, you know, my shitty car that's worth like maybe $20,000, I have to pay $300 every year for the title, as if that makes sense, right? And then there's, you know, they always complain that California gas taxes are so high. It's like, well, look at the percent of, or gas prices are so high. Look at the percentage of taxes you're paying at the pump. And they're doing this, right, where they're going to add on the environmental surcharges at the restaurants. And the other thing they're doing that I don't know, did we talk about this on the show? If we haven't, I've talked about this with lots of people because I rant about it. They're going to be adding a wildfire tax. Or they're talking about adding a wildfire tax to the water bill to everyone because they need help fighting the natural disasters in California. So, of course, they're going to add it to the water bill. You know, we're going to make water more expensive rather than, I don't know, just desalinating the ocean and making water more or bringing water cheaper for everyone. And I haven't said that in a while because Joe Rogan did that whole bit on his stand-up special. And I was like, he stole my bit. But it's true. We could make water cheaper, which would in turn help us fight the fires. But of course, we can't fight the fires with the ocean water because that does something to pollute the environment. So we have to use like a special chemical. I don't know. None of this makes any sense to me. It's just, to me, it's just an excuse to steal more money from people in California and make it more expensive here. And I don't know how anyone who's rational on any level, unless they make a shitload of money, would stay in California. Even if you're in San Diego where people are nicer and it's more chill, I don't know why you would say. I don't know how you could sit there and go, man, I could, my money could be going so much further somewhere else. I mean, even if, like, say you're president of a company, can't you just fucking work remotely? Can't you fly in? Wouldn't you save more money flying in every day from Arizona? I just don't understand. This is what I don't understand, Daniel. Maybe you guys can talk about this. I don't understand why people are okay with these nickel and diming taxes, these surcharges they're putting on. Are people just not paying attention? Are people just so used to it out here? I think a lot of Californians, people are used to how terrible it is out here, and they think that's the norm.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is the boiling of a frog. Is that what the expression is, where you turn the heat up gradually and it doesn't notice it's being boiled to death? But the other part of it is, and maybe I'll let William talk about this, is I think that most people think this is morally right.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think most people think about this not at all. Like, if you walked up to any random person, would they even know this thing? Like, do they even know the surcharges or what the level of gas tax is? All they know is that it sucks in California. Like, that part they know, that we're the vanguard of a lot of really crappy policies. That part they know, the general, you know, general populace knows. But, you know, I don't think people pay attention to the, you know, to get back to your boiling frog analogy, people aren't paying attention to the little increments that are happening here. But I think I think that we should turn this around. Like most things, if this is going to be a voluntary surcharge, I think the entire sales tax should be voluntary. That should be a voluntary surcharge, and maybe the gas tax should be a voluntary surcharge. I mean, if I'm supposed to be able to ask to remove this 1% charge from my bill, perhaps I should just ask that the gas tax be removed from my next fill-up. The other thing is too. So this is going to, this is basically a 1% charge to go to charity, right? Or, I mean, it's a little confused. I'm a little confused. So you're putting it on without asking, right? And then only removing it if they ask to be removed. So what's to stop me from, like, doing that at my own restaurant? You know, like, just finding some charity that I like, putting a 1% surcharge on. And then if anyone happens to notice, I can say, oh, well, you could just remove it if you want, but you're not virtue signaling properly if you do. So maybe I should raise money for, maybe there's a nuclear power charity or a desalination charity somewhere here in California that I could donate to counter this. What do you guys think?
I think it's a great idea, William. I mean, I think a line item for like the Ayn Rand Institute would go over very well in California.
And why stop at 1%? Why not 1,000%? I can just add that onto everyone's bill.
And just wait for them to take it off.
Mm-hmm. I want to say something about the voluntary part. Is I think that is just an excuse to get it on there, and then they're going to, at a later date, pass a resolution to have it not be voluntary. That's just rhetoric. That's the boiling frog principle Daniel was just talking about.
Of course. And eventually it'll be more than 1%, because that's, none of this goes in the other direction. None of it. The universe is a law of entropy. Government has a law of growth. Government never goes in the other direction unless we literally have a revolution. Not that I'm advocating for it, but it is the trend of things in the sense that it just continues to encroach until we slap its hand. I mean, the income tax first started as a temporary measure, and then it went away, and then it was a temporary measure again, and then we made it permanent, whatever. It was at 1%, and then it was 5, and then 10, and now what? The top bracket is some insane percent of your income, and people want to make it more. So that's the way these things go. This is what I'm most worried about, gentlemen, which is that this is just the forefront. This is just the precipice of what will eventually be, the woke surcharges everywhere, where you can't do anything without looking at your bill at the Staples or Taco Bell or your gas station without seeing a woke surcharge for something, because these companies want to virtue signal and they're going to be in cahoots with the state who wants the money. And this is just you're going to look at a bill and you're going to have 500 surcharges for various woke things that are like, oh, it's a quarter of a percent, half a percent, a third of a percent, whatever. And eventually it just becomes a new form of taxation.
Yes. And can we witness for a second the farce of saying carbon farming? I mean, it's carbon dioxide, not carbon, because every farmer is a carbon farm because, you know, they're growing carbon-based life forms. I love the fact that we're putting carbon in the ground. Oh, you mean you're tilling the land? Because every time you do that, you're putting carbon in the ground. What does this
mean? Yeah, I was
wondering
about that. I was curious about that. Putting carbon back into the ground.
Like, yeah, it's nonsensical. Like any carbon...
How does taking 1% of my bill do that?
Yeah, any carbon you put into the ground is going to get, you know, is going to decompose and go back in the atmosphere. That's how that works. It's called the carbon cycle. That's how carbon moves through between the atmosphere and the ground.
Daniel, there's also a social thing here about what you just said about having to check your bill every time. How do we look at people who are always being hypervigilant? I'm not making this about myself. I know it sounds like that, but it is going to be me. But it's already me, and I'll tell you, you know, how I do it already. But how do we look at people who are hypervigilant in that way, who always check the bill and make sure everything's okay with the bill and don't just pay it? Don't we look at them like they're crazy and they're wasting time and they're weirdos?
Yeah, well, when you go out and you're like line item checking it and be like, I'm pretty sure we only had 6 Diet Cokes.
Yes, Justin, you are a weirdo. Is that what you're trying to ask? I'm confused.
Well, no, I know the answer to that. That's not, I don't need that answer. But no, my point is, it's a rhetorical point to say, now if someone actually does that, people are just going to go, dude, just pay the 1%. We don't want to sit here and wait. Don't be that guy. And that's what's going to happen.
I look forward to being that guy. As long as this is voluntary, which it won't be for long, as long as it is voluntary, I thoroughly look forward to the day when I can go to the restaurateur, "Excuse me, sir, pardon me, please remove this propaganda nonsense from my bill post-haste."
Well, I'm good right. Day. And that's what I already am as far as plastic straws. I put the waiter or waitress on the spot by asking about if they have plastic straws or not. And then when they say they don't, I just start making fun of the paper straws and talk about how terrible they are. And it forces them to tip their hand whether they agree or not. And I enjoy doing that because it's like, fuck paper straws. I don't know if there are paper straws in D.C. yet, Daniel, but paper straws are the worst thing ever.
So in D.C., you can still get plastic straws, but you must ask for them. Like, they can't just give them to you. So now I have started, and I'm being 100% serious here, even though this sounds totally dickish. Like, if I'm out at lunch or whatever by myself and they give me a glass and I say, "Can I have a straw?" And they bring me a paper straw and I'll say, "May I have two plastic straws, please?" And they look at me funny and they bring me two plastic straws and then I throw one away. Because for every plastic straw you do not bring me, I will throw an extra one away. Take that, DC.
Wow, you've actually beat me on this. I thought I was being obnoxious, but you're being more obnoxious than I am.
Oh, I love it. And some of them are like, "I'm sorry, sir, why do you need two straws?" And I go, "I need two straws." And I just say it again, and then they bring me two straws, and I throw one away.
Well, you know, a lot of longtime listeners remember this, but I think I went on a rant a couple years ago about plastic bags and how we were going to just pass them out when they did the plastic bag ban. So I think we should do the same thing with straws. If we can get some of the mid-side straws and just go around to restaurants passing out the real straws.
The midside.com on the paper wrapper?
Yeah, yep.
Oh, gentlemen, and William in particular, you have come up with a perfect advertising strategy for the Midside podcast.
Yep, let's do it.
Plastic bags and plastic straws.
Discord, like, get it. To it.
It's a good idea. Yeah, somebody else out there, do it. That's a lot of effort. But no, Daniel,
that's pretty much the theme of this show. Could someone else be successful? Because it's way too much effort for us.
I have a question for you, because okay. California has the same thing where it's supposed to be plastic straws are only available upon request. But are all restaurants applying that equally? Because here there's still people who just give you plastic straws to start with.
So I think it's more regional. So like, I think in Santa Monica in California, they absolutely cannot give you a plastic straw without facing some obscene fine, but I don't know what the state rule is. I know that in D.C., they cannot give you one unless you ask. And I have been to many restaurants now, and they do not give you a plastic straw unless you ask for it. So I suspect it's just highly regional at this point.
Okay, that makes sense. The other thing is, I saw the other day, and I suspect this was just a lie, but I was at this other place that was like, "Oh, yeah, we have corn plastic straws. Plastic made from corn." And I had never heard of that before in my life.
Plant-based plastic.
And I got one, and it was like a normal plastic straw. So I'm pretty sure they were lying. What do you think?
There are plant-based plastics.
Yeah, there are.
That is a thing. And they're pretty much the same because they also rely on all the traditional elements.
They're made of
plastic.
Carbon.
It just happens to be that they're in some percentage plant-based. So it makes people feel better about themselves, even though I'm sure it's way more expensive to produce and is only made viable by the fact that we so heavily subsidize corn in this country. But I would take that as a victory. That's a loophole, man. And you should celebrate that at every pass.
You know what? I'm going to say, if anyone asks, that our straws are plant-based straws.
There you go. So I take it, William, that you, in your endeavors as a restaurateur, will not be adding the 1% carbon tax thing to your customers.
No. We will continue to do what we do, which is provide delicious sandwiches to hungry people and not require them to virtue signal at the cash register. Frankly, there's no time.
Oh, that is so sleepy of you. You are not woke at all. But someone was woke.
What I just heard, though, William, is that you're going to be giving free sandwiches to homeless people? That's what I just heard.
Well, you may have heard it, but it's not the reality. So, speaking of not reality, and someone who went from woke to broke, a vegan cafe that charged 18% man tax is set to close. Yes, Handsome Her, a vegan cafe in Melbourne, Australia, sparked global debate in 2017, even probably on this podcast, although I don't remember this at all, when it announced it would offer women priority seating and charge men an 18% premium to, quote, reflect the gender pay gap. After 2 years, the cafe announced it would be closing its doors for good on April 28th. That happens to be the day we're recording this. So, congratulations. Co-owner Alexandra O'Brien has not detailed the reason behind the move, but Handsome Her has endured a widespread backlash for its perceived reverse sexism. In a post entitled
perceived.
A Handsome Farewell, I know, love the journalism there. Ms. O'Brien wrote, quote, "It's been a wild journey, to say the least. When we opened Handsome Her in 2017, we expected that perhaps we might make a stir through our brazen public discussions of structural inequality and oppression. The man tax blew up the internet, an idea that we didn't think was all too radical. Yet the way the world responded showed us how fragile masculinity is and solidified the necessity for us to confront and dismantle patriarchy." So, Justin, was it the fragileness of masculinity that caused this place to close, or the fact that they basically cut out 50% of their customer base by telling them they're going to charge them 18% more than the other people who come in?
It's totally the fragileness. I mean, if men would just let go of their egos and understand the importance of paying more than women, then we would actually have this society we're in right now. So, I mean, really, men should just wake up and realize this is what's going on everywhere, right? I mean, no, it's, I mean, yeah. Obviously, I mean, this is obvious, right? Obvious is obvious, right? I mean, if you tell people they're going to pay more if they go here, they're not going to go there. Right? And I don't even know. I mean, is this a study that, like, shows that you can't just live solely off women? I mean, we've been marketing so long to women that this company tries to live only off women. And they fail. It's actually more. Well, this is probably actually what it more is. It shows that there are actually probably more women who are against this stuff than people realize. Because this not only had to be men not going, but it also had to be women boycotting this. Being like, why would I go to this that was oppressive towards men? Also, it's a marketing strategy. Why would you market this as an 18% surcharge? Or whatever. Was it 18 cents? What was it?
18%.
18%, which is even fucking worse if you think about it. 18% surcharge. Why would you not say we're going to give women an 18% discount on everything? Then all the stupid people that we were talking about in the first story who don't think about things will go, oh, okay, well, I'm just paying regular price then as a man. You know, it's what they do with all these stores where they mark shit up and then they're like, oh, we're going to give you a 25% discount this week. Oh, so you mean all your prices are 25% normal so you can just pretend you're giving us a discount?
Yeah, Justin, I think you're hitting the nail on the head because that's exactly what I was going to point out, that it's one thing when you positively market to a demographic, and it's another thing when you negatively market to a demographic, right? Nothing better illustrates that this kind of feminism is Marxism than this, right? It wasn't important for them to make money or for them to market or get business. It was to dump on men. That was their goal. Like, it wasn't anything else. So it's not that they want to lift up women. They want to put down everyone else.
Right, and they probably wanted to dump on men because they've been dumped so much by men in their life.
They're lesbians.
Well, why do you think they became lesbians? Because they couldn't
actually,
get the D.
There's a huge rift between mainstream lesbians and feminism, man. There's a huge rift.
What is this rift?
Justin, just say yeah, but still.
Yeah, but still.
Okay, there we go. We can move on with our lives.
I want to know what the rift is.
TERFs, man.
Oh, okay, yeah.
There's a lot of lesbian erasure going on with the transgender and the feminist support for very early childhood transitions. That's a whole thread to pull on someday.
How did this restaurant survive gender discrimination laws? It's a serious question. I mean, you can't, for instance, open a restaurant and say I'm going to charge Asians 18% more or something like that. You would be very quickly shut down. Now, this is Australia, so I'm not intimately familiar with their gender discrimination rules, but I suspect they've got to be as stringent, if not more so, than what go on in the United States. Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Our Australian listeners will have to chime in on Discord.
William, will you charge social justice warriors 18% more at your restaurant?
That's a great question. If I could figure out a way to do it, maybe there's some sort of social justice quiz on the way in. You have to pick the most oppressed minority.
Do they have gauges, and or are they wearing a the future is female shirt?
Okay, the future's female shirt is fine, but plenty of people are into pop punk and wear gauges and aren't left wing. So,
I don't know about plenty.
More than zero.
Point out a few.
William,
more than
it,
zero.
Is it
but I'm not sure it's plenty.
Is it legally required that you post your prices for your food?
Not only the prices, but the calories.
I know the calories part, but I would assume. I know the calories part, but the prices I didn't know. Okay, because I was going to say just don't post your prices, and then you just decide what you're going to charge based upon the person.
Exactly. Pardon me, if I say the word resistance to you, what do you think of? And if they don't say the new Star Wars series, 18% more.
Well, to be fair, I wouldn't say the word of the new Star Wars series if you said resistance.
No, what would you say?
Viva la resistance!
Yes and, Justin.
I would say
my God.
V over I, that's what I would say.
Wait, well is a version of yes and. I didn't say no. I said...
You basically said no.
No, I accepted your premise and went
now
in a different
no.
direction with it.
Now you said no.
Checkmate.
We'll get into Catch-22 later.
God damn it, this episode is terrible.
A study of 873 kids in Norway found that some girls who played video games frequently developed impaired social skills, but found no negative link with boy gamers. Playing video games may not necessarily impair children's social skills, says the Business Insider article for this week, and a new study suggests that any behavioral effect that frequent gaming might have may occur only in preteen girls. The rising popularity of video games in recent years has raised questions among parents, doctors, and educators about the potential for gaming to negatively impact children's psychological and social development, researchers note in Child Development, a journal, I suspect. But much of this research has focused on kids who spend too much time gaming or favor violent games. For the current study, researchers followed 873 Norwegian school children for 6 years, starting when they were 6 years old. Every 2 years, parents or kids reported how much time children spent gaming. Do you think that was supposed to be parents of kids? Do you think the kids reported how much time they spent gaming? Teachers also evaluated the social competence of the kids based on how well they followed directions, controlled their behavior, and exhibited confidence in social settings. After researchers accounted for factors that can independently influence social skills, like being overweight or obese or coming from low-income household where parents have less education, they didn't find any connection between time spent gaming and social skills for boys. However, for boys and girls, poor social competence at ages 8 and 10 predicted more time spent gaming 2 years later. And for girls only, the reverse was also true. Girls who spent more time gaming at age 10 showed poorer social skills 2 years later than girls who devoted less time to video games. Justin, are games sexist?
Inanimate objects can't be sexist or not. They don't make decisions. They're not volitional.
I don't know about that.
You just knowed me. How is that fair?
Mine was a joke.
I have a question. Yeah, because everything I say on this show is 100% serious.
Yeah, I know you. The audience may not.
I have a question. I want to make sure that I read and heard correctly.
Okay.
Did you say that 8-year-old boys, there was a predictive factor that if they had social difficulties at 8, they could predict that 2 years later they would be playing more video games?
Yes.
Wow. I never would have realized that people who had difficulty socializing when they were young would play video games. That's not something you can totally just induce from observing reality.
That's why we need studies, Justin, to back up what we can observe.
But this is reality. A perfect example of like correlation causation, where people are like, man, people who play video games are weird. Well, maybe they're weird, or they wanted to play video games because they were weird. They didn't become weird because of video games. And I know, William, I'm not saying everyone who plays video games is weird. You know that. I'm weird. Get on my case. Okay. Fine. Yes, and go. Go. Just go.
No, I think this is fascinating. I think there's Justin, you're making a great point that a lot of people have drawn a lot of conclusions about video games and video gamers, and try to put especially male video gamers into one category, that category being misogynist, right? And that's not true at all. And in fact, just like anything in this universe, the like what you do with the object is more important than the object itself. You know, gun owners aren't automatically evil, and video gamers aren't automatically socially awkward. Now, it's figuring out what the why we observe this this difference in women is interesting, but it also won't be looked at, I'm going to predict now, because it sort of falls in that, oh, there's a difference between boys and girls and we can't have any of that. So I think that'll be the end of this inquiry. No one else in science will ever look at this question again.
That's right. It seems to me that along the lines of what you two are talking about, that this article simply somehow, or this research simply somehow discovered that some people are introverted and some people are extroverted. That's basically how I read it, which is that some people prefer to do things where there's not a lot of social interaction, and some people don't. And there's no strong correlation that video games cause such thing, but there is some correlation in the fact that some people who want to be introverted then play video games because it's not as socially integrated.
How about that for wokeness? Now being introverted is being not socially good enough. Why are we not tolerant of introverted people?
That's right. But if wokeness was going to go after one of those two, it'd have to be the introverted people, right? Because they're not engaging in society. They're not being social. You know, humans are social animals and need to blah, 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 blah. And that's an interesting attack on video games. It's all these introverted, white, male, cisgendered, whatever. And yeah, we need to attack that. But overall, let's say even if this is all true, my question to either of you, both of you, you can answer is, so what? Who cares? What is the consequence if this study is 100% true?
Well, we should tell women to keep their hands off of our video games is what we should do. I mean, that's a consequence. I mean, it's one of those. This is the thing that scares me about all of this long term is this social engineering of society, right? We've always talked about, like, what if genetic engineering becomes so easy that the government can basically genetically engineer people, or even what if people who are rich can genetically engineer their kids? It's the same concept here. I'm not saying I'm against that. I'm just saying these are the topics people talk about. It's the same thing here. What if they decide what the right way to be is, and then they start deciding what people's activities are they're allowed to do or not is, and how much you're allowed to do per day. When I see studies like this, I don't ever see it just being like, oh, here's a way to keep people informed, which is the way it should be, right? Here's a way to keep parents informed. Here's a way to keep individuals informed about the consequences of their behavior. Instead, it becomes rationale for the government to start passing laws about what you can and can't do. That's what scares me about all this.
The intersection between science and government.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to say it in like three words instead of letting me go on a rant, sure.
That's what we do here. William, what's the so what of this article?
I don't know. I think it would be interesting because, remember, we're looking at this through the distortion of the journalist. So, you know, who knows how this fits into the current sort of academic research around video games. I think that's a good question. I think that part of me is afraid this will be used by the, you know, Anita Sarkeesians of the world to continue to beat the drum that video games are anti-women, right? It's like, look, they even poison the brains of women. They make them less social, right? But then that goes back to the, wait, are we trying to create some sort of Uber woman, right? Like, we're trying to, is that society's goal, is to create cookie cutter people, or is it like, you know, your individual happiness that you need to make?
Wait, is Uber woman Uber's new prostitution app?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Also, I think it would just be called Lyft. Oh, okay. William, I think you're onto something, and the last bit of this article that I'll point out is this one paragraph sort of buried toward the end that has this to say, quote, "The gender gap might have something to do with the differences in how girls and boys game and how they socialize," the study suggests. The gender gap? The gender gap?
The gender gap? As in, what? Like, the height difference between women and men at that age? Is that the gender gap
we're talking
about?
What the hell are we talking about? There's no explanation for what they refer to by the gender gap. It could mean anything, but the point is, it's the little sort of woke social justice-y
the
nugget that's in here.
The gender gap search. The gender gap is also a confidence gap. Women did everything right, then work got greedy. I think they're referring
to anything.
I think it's a term for the just for the pay gap.
I think also it could be that depending on what you define as games, men tend to dominate most, like be the largest demographic in most games, right? But it depends on how you define games, because, you know, mobile gaming, the split is much closer to, you know, population demographics. So I think it really depending on the game, the demographics can shift wildly, like what between male and female.
Oh, wow. Actually, so looking at this article, disparate outcomes between men and women remain one of the most contentious issues in American life. So they're taking this idea of the gender pay gap and they're expanding it outwards, and they're saying any differences in results between men and women is oppressive.
So I guess any day now they'll be looking at all the gap between male and female roofers, huh?
Probably. No.
Okay. Speaking of ridiculousness, health officials are casting doubt on reports of a herpes spike at Coachella. Justin, I think you threw in this article simply for the headline.
No, I read the article. I think there's a couple interesting things going on in this article.
This article is ridiculous. Okay. Jose Arbalo of the Riverside Department of Public Health is saying he hasn't seen evidence to corroborate recent reports of a surge in cases of herpes in Southern California during the Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival, Billboard reports. TMZ previously reported that there was a, quote, massive surge in folks seeking prescriptions for herpes since day one at Coachella. The publication, citing online STD diagnosis and treatment website HerpAlert, reported that 1,105 cases of herpes were reported since the festival's first day. HerpAlert said that they usually receive around 12 cases a day in the area. But Arbalo wasn't convinced. Quote, "I reached out to our lab department's disease and control and our HIV and STD program, and none of them reported a spike in herpes cases." Sita Walsh, spokesperson for Planned Parenthood of the Pacific Southwest, said the organization didn't see any measurable increase. Walsh continues, quote, "They didn't go to Coachella and get herpes. They arrived at Coachella with herpes or other sexually transmitted infections." Justin, what?
I just wanted to hear you say Herp Alert over and over again.
Yeah.
Herp Alert.
There's a website for everything these days.
That's a great website. That name is amazing. No, I mean, first of all, there's two things that are hilarious to me or that I find really interesting. The first thing is, so you live in this area, Coachella. Coachella is the name of a town. That's why the festival is called Coachella. I say that not to talk down to you all listeners, but because I didn't know that. And then when I found that out, I was like, that's dumb. And you live where there's not a lot of people. Then all of a sudden, a lot of people come in and there are more people there requesting STD medicine. So there's a spike. Isn't the logical conclusion that the people there that came in are the ones with herpes? Not suddenly there's a lot more herpes in your area? Like, I don't know. It's just clickbait headlines to the nth degree with this TMZ story that started all of this story.
Maybe that Herp Alert kiosk had something to do with it. I don't know. Were they giving out their website or giving out herpes? I'll have to ask. I have a friend that went to Coachella, so I have to ask him if he got herpes.
There was a Herp Alert kiosk at Coachella?
No, that was the joke, Justin.
Oh, I don't know. I'd believe it.
Yes, and
would an app that showed you all the Maryland fans around you be called Terp Alert?
No, that's where you go if you're a Maryland fan and you're just so upset about how terrible you are at sports.
What about an app that showed you all the people who around you who like soft air shooting guns? Would that be called Nerf Alert?
Yes, that's a good one. Also, why is the sex offender registry not named Perp Alert?
Because it sounds like a weird color. That's not quite purple. That's Perp Alert. Yeah. No, that's halfway between. Yeah, no, that's definitely Perp Alert.
Okay, so assuming people aren't going to Coachella and getting herpes from a kiosk. All right, so let's not assume
that.
I'm going to put that to the side. But that is a valid theory. I like that theory. I like the idea that we can just put up a kiosk somewhere, and it'll give diseases to the stupid people so we can weed people out that way. I feel like this is a Bill Burr joke where he talks about, like, anyone who takes a cruise ship, just sink the cruise ship. That's what I feel like this is. It's the same thing where it's like, hey, let's just put up kiosks, and it's like, oh, touch here, and then you just get a disease and die within 5 days. That's a good idea. I like it, William. I like the way you're thinking. Well, let's put that aside. What does this say about the people who go to Coachella? This is what I've been saying for years about these festivals and why I can't stand this fucking behavior. This is not about music. This is not about art. This is not about anything rational. This is pure self-destruction. People want to go out in the middle of the desert where there's no one, and it's impossible to police all of them unless you just break up the entire festival. And they want to go out there and they want it to an excuse to just
get
harm their bodies.
Yeah,
get herpes. They want to do drugs. They want to have
do each other
irresponsible sex. Right, I'm not saying don't have sex, but I'm saying they're being irresponsible. These are people who are being completely irresponsible. They're harming themselves, and this is scientific proof of it. The idea that they're going there and they have this kind of thing. So then now I have two minds. Should I continue to hate Coachella for that reason, like the straight edge person in me just continued to decry Coachella, or should I celebrate the fact, Daniel and William, that we have now made socially acceptable a weeding out process?
Anyone who goes to Coachella is weeded out of your life?
No. They're moving more quickly, more swiftly towards their own death and self-destruction. Oh. And we're saying, we're celebrating that. We're saying, yay, you're wow. So cool. You're killing yourself.
You went weirdly Darwinian with this.
Well, should we continue to support this then? Should it, rather than make fun of it, I should go, man, did you go to Coachella? Wow, that's a really good job. And yes, then also cut them out of my life.
Well, just like video games, I think that you can go to festivals like this for the music, right?
Well, obviously, I'm not saying you can't.
I don't want to throw all Coachella attendees into the hedonist category.
Yeah, because there goes our entire Liberty.me audience.
Yeah. But you're right. There is a large segment here that goes there just for the debauchery, right?
That's like saying the people who go to EDM festivals aren't going there just to dress half naked and take acid. Come on.
You could say that about any concert, though. And I've seen you at several concerts. You don't even take your shirt off.
It's like reading Playboy for the articles.
Look, no, you can go to festivals. Like, I don't think this new Warped Tour festival thing they're doing is going to become like a huge drug thing. But there are people at Warped Tour who smoke weed. Without a doubt, I'm sure other drugs have been done at Warped Tour. But there's a difference to me here. The difference is what the majority of people conceptualize it as. What is Coachella seen
as? I think you have a stronger case against Burning Man than Coachella, but I think I see where you're going with this.
Oh yeah, Burning Man is the more extreme version. Coachella is like the basic Instagram girl version of Burning Man.
Ha, you should be their marketing director.
Why? They already do that.
We're the Instagram version of Burning Man.
What an app that shows you all the people who could lead you up a mountain be called Sherp Alert. I'm done.
Are you sure?
Just to honor that joke, I'm going to add a chirping crickets sound to the drop panel. So just for you.
See, that would have been good. That would have been good. All right.
Come on.
Let's talk about something else that people told me should have been good or would have been good and actually wasn't good.
Oh.
It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML. If you missed the Midsiders rising up against me this week and demanding I watch Chocolat thanks to Daniel's reference 2 weeks ago, then you weren't in the Discord channel, and you should be in the Discord channel. So go to themidside.com/podcast and click on any of our episodes, and you will find a link to joining the Discord channel. As you also heard this week, we accept stories submitted by listeners, because sometimes you all are the best identifiers of farce. And Daniel, why did you do that on the show?
In some ways, I was cajoled by a Midsider. I'll put that out there. I was cajoled by a Midsider Conrad to get you to watch Chocolat. But in other ways, I genuinely like Chocolat, and I thought you should see it. I thought you, of all people in the whole world, should see it because it has elements of romanticism, and I thought you'd appreciate it.
Well, we can talk about that in a second, but Midsiders out there, this is a window into Daniel's personality, because Midsider Conrad did in fact message me, and I won't read those messages, but he kind of quasi-apologized because he wasn't intending for you to go the direction you did with it, which has caused a Midsider uprising. So this took on a life of its own, and I think this is the second most controversial topic in the show's history after the backing into parking spots.
Let's not revisit that.
I actually saw a sign the other day that was like, no backing into parking spots. And I was like, really? This has become such a trend? Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Chocolat, shall we?
Let's do it.
The first thing I didn't realize was how many Academy Awards this movie was nominated for.
Yeah, it did crazy well in the award seasons, even though it doesn't have a particularly great Rotten Tomatoes ranking. I don't remember what it is. I'm going to look it up right now, but it's not superb.
Which is surprising that it would do so well with the awards, because it isn't a very typical Hollywood message or theme in it. It's actually very... I mean, I get why people like it who listen to this show. I would say it's a very objectivist movie. What would you say?
Well, yes, I would say that it has themes in it that would appeal particularly to objectivists.
Correct. I agree with that statement, except you mean motifs. There can only be one theme. Everything else is a motif.
Yeah, okay. I was using the not technical term.
Okay, well, I'm on a personal crusade now in my life to destroy this. Every student I have, I teach them the difference between theme and motif, because I'm so sick of fucking people. This is Justin's rant this week, apparently. I'm so sick of fucking people talking about the multiple themes in stories. It makes it impossible to have conversation.
Hey, some stories are so jumbled, they do have multiple themes.
Okay, well, that's just a terrible movie. True. Yes.
So, Rotten Tomatoes has it at 62% of reviewers, so just barely fresh. But 83% of the audience liked it out of 328,000 audience ratings.
So
then my question is, do you think Hollywood liked this movie just because of the anti-religious themes that were in it, the anti-Catholicism themes?
Well, it came out in 2000, which is sort of just before we start getting into the super woke era of things, even though it was still there. I'm not going to say it wasn't, but it's before we get into it in some major way. And so I think Hollywood liked it in part because we were still in this era of the old school academy that was genuinely looking for performances. And I think the lead actress, what's her name? Justin.
Binoche or something? B-I-O-N-C-H-E? I don't know how to say it.
No. Binoche. Binoche?
Binoche. I think that's how you say it, correct.
Yes. Okay.
I don't know. Sorry, I'm not French. Binoche is actually, I am part French.
She's not a South American dictator.
Is Binoche like Pinochet's like brother who got power through like using beans?
It's his illegal Mexican brother. Juliette Binoche.
That was a better joke.
Thank you. I thought no matter what you think of the movie, just her performance is an excellent performance. And then you have Johnny Depp in the movie, who also gives an excellent performance. And you also have any number of great actors. Alfred Molina gave an outstanding performance. And I just think
you didn't even name the best performance.
Well,
the best performance in the entire movie was Judi Dench.
Of course.
Well, stop teasing us and give us a synopsis. I haven't seen this movie, so what is it about? Is it about chocolate?
A little bit. It is. I mean, chocolate is a symbol in the movie. So there's this small French village in Easter or in Lent. Sorry, before Easter, super Catholic town. Who it's basically the mayor, who also is the count. So the count is the mayor. So we have this whole thing about like meritocracy versus the old school feudalism type of deal. The count is also the mayor, and he uses religion to keep people in line, specifically very Catholic, using guilt to keep people from indulging themselves in general, right? They always have to worry about being contrite and feeling bad about things. And then in the middle of Lent, this woman comes in on the north wind, with her daughter, and they open up the chocolatery, or however you say it, I don't know, fucking the chocolate store. They open up the chocolate store, okay? It's like Rocky Mountain Chocolate, right? Down the street from me, Rocky Mountain Chocolate. They open that up.
Just like that.
And through selling chocolate, they help people get through their repression and have better lives. For instance, one of the major characters in the movie is this abused wife. And through her running away from her husband and becoming the assistant in the chocolate shop, her abusive husband eventually is kicked out of the town. We're able to see his sort of corruption, and that leads to him fucking up in a way that gets him kicked out of the town. So it's all about decadence versus repression, hedonism versus repression, and where is sort of the balance between those two. That is what I would say. And also, of course, when you're discussing that, there's a lot about the self and self-destruction and what actually is self-destructive or not. And that's actually why Judi Dench's performance is so compelling and why the plot is interesting, because she's old and she's dying and she's diabetic and she just wants to have like one last hurrah. But that one last hurrah makes her die quicker, because her last hurrah is just like, we're going to eat steak and we're going to pour lots of chocolate on it. So you're like essentially putting her into a diabetic coma. So it's almost like assisted suicide via chocolate. So there's a lot of this sort of interesting. What? That is an accurate description. There's a lot of interesting things going on there. But it also, this sort of points to my thing about this movie. There was a lot to like about this movie conceptually. Okay, everything I just said is wonderful conceptually. But when you understand that this was based on a book, it just makes me go, this had to have been a million times better as a book. It was just, I was very surprised at two things. I was very surprised when I found out that this came out in the year 2000. The way this was shot and the way it was paced felt like it came out in like 1995. When I was watching it, I was like, this movie's from like 1996. That's what I thought in my head. So
okay, well,
2000 is not that far off from 1996.
Right, and the guy who directed it was also the guy who did, like, What's Eating Gilbert Grape, so it's that sort of style of a movie. And then the second thing was to find out it was nominated for, like, things like Best Picture. I mean, in the beginning, some of the editing is very choppy. The scenes are just jumping from scene to scene. It was like, remember the huge critique of the first Atlas Shrugged movie that it was a series of vignettes? Well, this movie in the beginning was very much a series of vignettes. It wasn't, there wasn't any sort of through thread besides the fact that the Count was an idiot. And even the Count storyline, like, it would have been much more compelling if rather than he binges on chocolate at the end and he's like, oh my God, I binged on chocolate. Oh man, that's how I decide to give in to hedonism. And then they go, oh, and by the way, 5 years later, he accepted that his wife wasn't coming back and he got with the woman he's in love with. It would have been much better, much more compelling if he overcame his guilt by hooking up with that woman. That's where I thought it was going, and it would have been much more interesting. And that's sort of my issue with this movie as a whole. It just wasn't that interesting to me. Just the way it was executed. And again, it probably was a lot better in the book. It just, they didn't take the best possible options. I liked the setup. I liked the concepts behind this. But let's give an example of the Johnny Depp storyline. So halfway through the story, these river rats show up and they're, you know, basically sort of like hippies, whatever. And they live on their own.
Gypsies,
hippies, whatever. So they're basically gypsies. And nobody likes them because, you know, they're morally impure. And we're supposed to boycott the moral impurity. So, of course, you know, the Mary Poppins of chocolate woman falls in love with him. And there's a whole thing of, like, how he helps her. And then he just disappears. And then after the problem is solved, after the conflict's over, it's like, and then he showed up a year later and they were in love again. So what was the point of his character? In the movie, as a plot, there's really no point of his character besides to give her someone to fall in love with. You could cut him out completely and the movie would stay the same. Now, again, in the book, there probably was more integration. But in the movie as is, it's just not that integrated. Now, again, I get why objectivists in particular would love their interactions, because he comes and he fixes her door, John Galt. And then she says, I insist on paying you for this. And then he goes, well, I insist on the same thing. Literally an interaction between John Galt and Dagny in Atlas Shrugged. So I get it. Like, I get why our audience in particular would love this movie. But I just think there are better movies out there. That's all.
I think there's no doubt better movies out there. I think this is, to borrow a phrase that may or may not apply, but I think it applies. You know, Ayn Rand had this thing for, like, tiddlywink music that wasn't this grand symphonic expression of human achievement, but was benevolent and good and simple and melodic, harmonic, etc. That's how I feel about this movie. It's a simple fairy tale that's told basically well. It has benevolence to it. It has good themes to it. It has good acting to it. Is it the pinnacle of film? Certainly not. But, you know, if there's ever a time when you're in the dearth that is modern filmmaking and you want to just relive something that was tiddlywinky in the film realm, you should watch Chocolat. A tiny bit of insight here, I think, is that this is Chocolat is based on a novel, Justin, but it's that novel is basically a ripoff of Like Water for Chocolate.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Mary Poppins.
No, that was an excellent analogy, though. They're Mary Poppins of chocolate. But it's basically a ripoff of Like Water for Chocolate, which is sort of a Latin American version of this. And the Latin American version of this is very much magical realism. Like, the chocolate has magical powers to it. That does various things. And this is sort of like just the European version of that. That's toned down a bit in the magicalness of it.
But see, that makes more sense because the chocolate's more integrated into the plot. That was one of the things that I didn't really like. They only did it at one part where in the beginning, like, she sold the nubs to that really passionless couple. And then, like, they had it and it became a literal aphrodisiac and they were just coming back and buying it constantly. That was the one point where, like, buying the chocolate and consuming the chocolate actually helped with the repression. Otherwise, it was constantly like, well, what's your favorite? And it was like the favorite, like, that should have been actually reflective of their personalities, but that was never really established. It was just sort of like, oh, isn't this a cool quirk she has?
Yeah. So for anyone who wants more of the magical side of this, the fantastical side of this, go read or watch the read the book or watch the movie like Water for Chocolate, which I think is in some ways a more pure version of the movie book, whatever, Chocolat, and in some ways a little less culturally familiar in the sense that it has many, many more Latin American themes to it. But if you're fine with that, then check that out. But overall, I think Chocolat deserves accolades just for the acting. I think the acting is tremendous for the most part, even if the writing fails. So that's how I'll defend the movie.
Two things. One, so you're saying if people want a more pure version of chocolate to go to Latin America.
To add water, yes.
Where isn't that where like the nibs are from? Aren't they from mainly South America?
Africa, right?
Oh, Africa. Yeah, cacao. Cacao's from Africa? Okay, I stand corrected.
I suspect you... Look, I honestly don't know. I suspect you could probably grow it in multiple places in the world. So there's probably African chocolate, South American chocolate, Asian chocolate. I'm not a chocolate expert.
Well, I think you are an expert at defending this movie, because I would agree with everything you said. I mean, I thought the best part was the performances. I mean, I thought Alfred Molina, Judi Dench, and Johnny Depp were phenomenal. I mean, in particular, when I was watching this movie, I was like, it's very obvious how skilled of an actor Johnny Depp is. I thought he stood above everyone else. Although, can I say something funny about this that I don't know if you remember this, Daniel? But do you remember the daughter was always talking about, like, pirate invasions? And then Johnny Depp shows up, and she's like, are you a pirate? And then he says a couple things. He's like, well, I guess you could say I'm a pirate. And I was like, it's Captain Jack Sparrow! That was my favorite part of the movie.
I didn't remember that particular interaction. I think I literally last saw this movie in high school. We watched it once in English, and then we watched it once in French in my French class, which shows you how little French we actually studied.
Exactly. And I have one final question/observation. I thought one of the best shots of the movie was the opening when they were all in the church and they showed the wind busting open the church doors. I thought the way that was shot was very innovative and interesting. And I thought just the visual symbolism of that was great. Like that shot in particular is like movie making at its best. Because it's sort of like, you know, oh my God, like the symbolism of like they're going to blow into this town and they're going to make them question the morals and really think about what morality is all about. And, you know, they're literally going into the church. I thought that was phenomenal. But what was the deal with the wind? Is this just the magical realism element that they borrowed that
winds
they didn't
in the
go
east,
in depth with?
Mist coming in.
Yeah, there's something about... the north wind or something, the west wind, whatever. There's something about the direction the wind blows that has some, historical symbolic symbolism to it overall. But it is, I think, mostly a borrowing of an element of the magical realism from like Water for Chocolate that doesn't get paid off really at all in this film.
Right, because this is another example of the writing at the end of the movie, and I think the way you put it that the acting was phenomenal, but the writing lets it down. At the end of the movie, like the winds, so she's helped this town, right? And the premise is that her and her mother went around and were helping people with their red coats. I don't know, coats isn't the word, but they put a hood up and they're like shawls almost. It reminded me, honestly, it reminded me of the yellow shawls in The Village. So her and her mother went around and helped people from town to town, and her daughter have been wandering and helping people from town to town. And then they solve everything in this town and they finally make a home. And then at the end, the wind starts blowing and the main character is like in her narration is like, you know, I felt the wind and I observed it and I reflected on it and I realized that someone else would help people somewhere else. And I was like, that's just a way of like writing out why she's not leaving. Like, it wasn't explained like her mission is done or, you know, it became less windy. It was just, she just chose to ignore the wind, which, I mean, again, I like from a selfish perspective, because she's like, this is my home now. And the more selfless ending would have been like, I knew my calling and had to go, but it wasn't executed well.
Yeah, that's a good point. Never thought about that. It's a good point.
Okay, so put that aside. Sorry if I pissed you off, Midsiders out there. Sorry, not my intent, but you wanted my opinion. That's my opinion. Let's move on now. Let's talk about some movies that are going to come out. As always, Trailer Takedown is posted on the website on Saturday mornings. You can go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, and you can watch the trailers before the episode, or you can watch them after the episode, or you can alternate in between. You watch a trailer, we talk about it. You watch a trailer, we talk about it.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Knock Down the House is a documentary about women in the democratic process that I included just for Daniel. It follows four women in this latest surge in the, was it the midterm elections, Daniel?
Yes.
Yeah, in the midterm elections, who won their houses, because it was in the midterms, Daniel, or won their seats. In the midterms, was it the greatest number of women who were elected in our government? Is that what it was?
Yes.
Right.
Indeed.
So this documentary is supposed to be capturing that wave. Now, of course, it stars AOC.
AOC.
AOC, yeah. Is not A-OK. And look, this is the best thing I will say about this documentary. Watching this documentary, it is very obvious why she is able to rise to the heights she has and why she is popular. She's well-spoken. She's carried herself well, and she generally comes off positively. You don't get like a negative vibe from her. It's really only when you're paying attention to what she's actually saying and you're looking at her actual words and meaning that you realize how terrible she is. But watching this, I can understand why, just from a pure ethos perspective, people voted for her. This documentary, I don't know, because I don't know all of the candidates, the four, but knowing it's Netflix and knowing it focuses on AOC, I get the impression that this is a very leftist hit piece on our current culture and a leftist promotional piece. This is almost a promotional piece for the Democratic Party. I could be wrong. Maybe Daniel will correct me. I hope he corrects me. But for me, this is a tackle.
Tackle.
No, I will not correct you. I suspect it is this. In fact, I haven't watched it yet, but to do a spoiler here, I will watch it. In fact, I'm going to hug this because I'm interested in the topic, but also because it's very well done. And this is going to be a continued part of our political culture now, is everyone is hiring these documentarians to follow them during their campaigns. Romney did this, and they made the mistake, I think, of releasing it after the election, when I think it may have had an impact if they'd released it before the election, because it made Romney look like a goddamn human being instead of some Mormon weird robot, which he clearly is. So this one's interesting. But as a side note for those out there, another interesting one of these that went the opposite direction is none other than Anthony Weiner hired a documentary team during his, I believe, his election for New York governor or New York mayor. One of the two, and they were following him at the exact time the craziness unfolded with his scandal, and that's being released or is out already as a documentary called Weiner. So sometimes these can go very poorly. But point being, this is going to be a continued genre that we see, and I'm fascinated to see not only how it's constructed and if it's objective, but how the politicians present themselves in this documentary format. This might be filed under, for me, Know Thy Enemy, and that's why I'm particularly curious to watch it, but I will hug it.
Netflix and hug.
I mean, it continues my... it's literally Netflix and hug. That's funny, William, because
hey,
Netflix is a production
company.
I'm doing
my job.
You're doing a good job, man. Keep it up. This continues my comment that AOC is the Instagram candidate. Instagram politician, because I mean, that's basically what she just did. She was like, you know how we have Instagram stories? Let's just do an entire documentary like that. Cause that's all Instagram stories are. They're just like little documentaries. And the second thing is, and I guess I've already answered my question, but since we already have Instagram stories and we already have the politicians having documentarians follow them around everywhere, how long until we have every person has documentarians following them around?
Hmm. Yeah, other than ourselves.
You mean you don't? Yeah. I was going to say, I carry my phone everywhere.
Once we get those little drones that can just hover there and follow you around.
They already have those.
It will be...
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but they're not great for outdoor use and whatever. But
you mean indoor once use. They get better, work fine outdoors. It's indoors that you don't want to use them.
Right, maybe
no,
it's...
like, I'm talking about these little pocket drones that fly around perfectly well inside your home. But if you take them outside, a small gust would destroy them.
Yeah, maybe it's just my writer's brain, but I'm thinking of like closed circuit television. We've got, as Daniel just said, these little drones flying around.
So the Big Brother production house.
Right, exactly. But it's for everyone. And they're just making a series out of whatever they can. And they're cutting several different series and, you know, a huge number of them, because they literally have drones everywhere and they can, you know, find who they think is interesting in the situation and then keep following them. And then they even have them in our houses and everything, or they use our phones or something. And they're cutting documentaries of everybody or whoever they want. Now, yes, I know,
Reality
of course,
Earth.
Exactly. Reality Earth. Now, of course, I know the government would use that to spy on everyone. I'm not advocating for any of this. I'm just saying I could see that world coming from this sort
seems
of trend.
Like a, seems like a Black Mirror episode where there's like a catalog and you can like just swipe through and tune into literally anyone's life.
Exactly. 100%.
And then the plot I'm imagining is that this guy flips to a channel and it's blank and you can't see anything. And he becomes so fascinated with why you can't see anything that he starts stalking this guy who's basically turned off his life from the world. There you go. I wrote a Black Mirror episode. You're welcome, Netflix.
All right, William, it's your turn.
Well, I, for one, was slightly disappointed by this AOC presidential campaign ad and wonder when the FEC is going to crack down on this this illegal political speech that is occurring.
Ooh.
So I don't think I'll be seeing this. I agree with Justin that this probably will not be a documentary. It's just a campaign ad. So I don't know what I would get out of this, because I'm not a political junkie like Daniel, so I'm going to tackle.
Second trailer.
21 Bridges is an action movie starring Chadwick Boseman. He is a cop who's trying to figure out what's going on in New York City by closing all 21 bridges. This is an interesting one for me, because I like a lot of this plot. I like a lot of this story. It's interesting. It's the kind of movie I want to see. It's just that there was nothing very unique about this one in specific. I feel like I've seen this movie a million times before. Now, that said, I have a feeling what's going to happen is it's going to come out at a time when there's not a lot in theaters, and I'm probably going to end up seeing this. So this is one that instinctively, when I'm watching the trailer, it's like, yeah, this is cool, but I don't want to spend time on it, so it feels like a tackle, but I'm going to be completely honest. I know myself. This is probably going to end up being a hug.
Hug.
Exactly. Exactly. Daniel?
This is a movie my wife will watch 10 or 11 times in theaters, but I will not see it. Despite the fact that I do think the cast looks excellent for this particular film. All I thought at the beginning was like... this was the first reaction that came to me, despite the fact that I knew it wasn't real. Like when his parents were killed and they all the police, whatever, I was like, oh my God, they're making Chad Boseman into Batman now. For whatever reason, that was my first thought. And if that was the movie, Chad, what's his name? Chadwick Boseman. If he was the next Batman, I'd probably be more inclined to see it.
He's otherwise, already Black Panther.
Hackle.
I know, but that's a different universe.
What is Black Batman? Just Black Man?
No. Although he'd have to do less eye makeup.
Wait, why does he have to dress in blackface if he's Batman?
No,
all white bat suit.
Dan, you just made a great point. Maybe Batman should be black.
I know.
It makes more sense than like the fact that, oh man, I'm gonna go fight crime. I gotta go put on eye grease. Like he's a fucking wide receiver.
Exactly.
Man, Nolan. Come on, Christopher Nolan. You dropped the ball on that one.
That's right.
Get the woke William? Points. Yeah, I too like action movies. So this one looks okay, though. There's there seems to be a bit of a mystery they're teasing, but we all know the answer, right? It's the evil capitalists that are behind all of this. It looks like it
the
has
evil
some...
white capitalists.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess I will probably hug it the same way you did, Justin. I probably will go see this, but I probably won't see it in theaters. I'll probably wait till it's on my Apple TV.
Hug.
Right, like, it's not one, like, we're going to be excited about, like, and be looking forward to, but then at some point we know we're going to see it, so we're not going to pretend otherwise.
Third trailer.
Catch-22 is the latest in Hulu's literature to web series adaptations. Stars George Clooney. I think Jeremy Irons is in there, too. I think I saw him at some point. And I will say this about this. It did capture the satirical nature of the book. I thought it was kind of funny. There were parts where I was like, oh, that was well done. But I'm not going to see this. This is fuck off, Hulu. You're not the literature. You're not the literature of streaming platforms. Just leave these books alone, okay? I know everyone loves you because you went with the social justice route. And you're trying to pick these very provocative books that appeal to leftists to try and get clout. You're clout chasing, Hulu. Stop clout chasing, Hulu. Tackle.
Tackle?
I wasn't angry.
You were angry. Midsiders, was he angry? He was angry. Unlike Justin, I will absolutely be watching this series, as this is one of my favorite and maybe only one of the sort of contemporary literature books that I thoroughly enjoyed reading throughout college, because I think it is so well written, and I think that this, at least the trailer, captured the feel that I got from the book. This has been tried before, I think, as a movie maybe a couple times, and at least the one I saw just didn't get it.
The John Voight one?
I think so. Yeah, it just didn't feel like the book at all. But this movie this trailer felt like the book, which is good. I don't enjoy much modern literature at all. I think most of it is pretentious nonsense. But this book spoke to me in some strange way when I was in college. So I will definitely be watching this. Enthusiastic hug.
Hug.
So, you know, I'm very picky when it comes to comedies, but I did get a couple giggles, and this has guns, explosions, and naked, half-naked men wrestling, so I guess that meets my criteria for giving this comedy a chance. I'm going to give it a hug.
Hug. Final trailer.
Gemini Man is Will Smith's return to an action blockbuster. In it, his 25-year younger clone is sent to kill him. That's it. That's the premise, ladies and gentlemen. And you know what? I am in so hard for this movie. I love Will Smith. The science fiction premise of this is great. I'm not totally sold on the aging down CGI they use for younger Will Smith. I'm not even sold on the way this premise was edited, or this trailer was edited. It was really interesting to me that they took the perspective of the younger guy. And then at the end, they were like, the old guy comes in, he was like, the older Will Smith is like, yeah, they made you for me, and now they sent you to kill me. Why did they send you to kill me? They could have sent anyone on Earth. And like, yeah, that's what's interesting about it. But then why would you not tell the story from the perspective of older Will Smith? Why is it from younger Will Smith? Is it because from younger Will Smith he doesn't know? And there's the whole reveal here, but then have they spoiled the reveal in the trailer? Basically what I'm saying is I think the movie is going to be 10 times more compelling than this trailer is. So this is a big hug for me.
Hug.
They lost me at the line, he's better than you because he is you. Tackle.
Tackle.
You know, I've been avoiding Will Smith movies, and rightfully so. The trailers have been awful. This trailer is not awful, but it's not good. But I like the premise. I actually like the premise. There's a little bit of self-awareness with Will Smith taking this role. I mean, he is not his younger self. I mean, It's hard to top such classic performances as Independence Day. But hey, I'm in. I want to see this.
Hug.
I think I'd rather watch Independence Day again than see this movie.
Why not both?
Double feature.
Wouldn't that be an interesting marketing tactic to get people in to see these newer movies, which is come to see Independence Day, stay for Gemini Man?
I mean, they're not doing that with Marvel, where they're like, what was that one place that did like the 52-hour marathon of every Marvel movie?
I get it. I'm just saying theaters want to make more money, sell more tickets, show a movie that you definitely know people love, like Independence Day, and then hopefully they'll stay for Gemini Man. You're welcome, movie theaters.
So a lot of marketing advice on this episode. I think that brings us to a nice end. Let's put a bow on this episode. What did we learn this trip? Who goes first usually? William? Daniel? Daniel?
How do you not know this by now? It's also in the outline.
It's in the outline, yeah.
I'm not reading the outline. I'm looking up Funko Pops on eBay.
Oh, jeez. Well, I'll tell you what I learned this trip.
Dedication to the show.
I learned that the homeless in San Francisco will be adding a 2% surcharge to every piece of feces that they excrete onto the street.
Oh, God. I learned that our Midsiders submit excellent articles, and that I actually forgot to mention that it was Midsider Megan who submitted the Vegan Cafe article, so thank you for that. But I also learned that my dad humor goes totally unappreciated on this show, and I don't like it. I will not stand for it. I will increase the dad humor by 50% until it is liked. I'm going to be the Andy Dufresne of dad humor on this show. I'm going to ratchet it up until... jerk. Until it's appreciated. Justin, what did you learn?
You will not stand for this. You will continue to sit as you record the episodes.
That's right. Thank you. Someone who finally gets it.
Now I forgot what I learned.
So you didn't learn anything.
That stupid joke. No, oh yeah, I know,
how much
no,
a DuckTales
I know what I learned.
Pop costs on eBay.
I learned that I learned that the pop I was looking at yesterday is now $2 more expensive today on eBay. What the fuck? No, I learned that I was correct and that everyone who goes to Coachella is a dirty whore.
Well, we hope you learned something this week in this very weird episode of Welcome to the Midside. If you did, you can go to iTunes or whatever it's called now, Apple Podcasts or Google Play, and leave us a 5-star review. We really appreciate all of our 5-star reviews. It helps us move up the rankings and beat people like Welcome to Night Vale, the bastards. And you can also go to themidside.com/podcast and catch up on all the shows, including shows from years back. I mean, my God, we're in year 7 of this craziness, which is total nonsense. I don't know why anyone keeps listening. But thank you for listening. You can go to themidside.com/store and buy some merch. Thank you to Liberty.me for syndicating us. Patreon.com/themidside is where you can go to give us a couple bucks every time we produce a piece of content. It really helps us keep the lights on and keep the eBay pops flowing.
That is incorrect. I have never once used podcast money to buy a pop. Just wanted to clarify. Mm-hmm. Except the two that
Except
we use
for...
as the giveaway. No, the two we
Thank
use as
you.
The giveaway.
That's right. Don't lie.
I wasn't intending to lie. I just forgot because that was like how many seasons ago?
Feels like forever. And if you can't do any of that, that's fine. But please tell a friend about the show. That really is the most important thing you can be doing every week is telling a friend. I know after all these weeks, you're probably out of friends, but some of them haven't listened. So maybe you could tell them again. Tell a friend again. Hashtag one more time and get them turned on to the show.
One more time.
Is that a song?
Yeah.
Were you singing?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell. So thanks again for listening. And until next week when I have the stroke corrected from this week. We love you.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelzeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Hello, ladies. Have a day.
I had forgotten that Midsider Dan recorded that drop.
Well, I'm slowly adding them all in.
I was like, did William start smoking? Crazy. Every so often, gentlemen, we have a week where the show feels surreal, and that was this week. I don't know what went on, if you're all tired, if I'm certainly tired, but it felt very surreal this week. Not a bad thing every once in a while, but...
Yeah, it was almost a very meta episode with the whole environmentalist stuff that you love to talk about, the California stuff, then the whole like Midsiders having me watch Chocolat thing. It was very like, it was a show almost about itself this week.
Seinfeldian.